Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton and Raphael Baer about why the Tories are suddenly looking so chipper. Ian Steadman and I discuss death on Mount Everest, and Sophie McBain and I talk about why we're all feeling so very anxious. I'm joined by George Eaton, Editor of The Staggers, and our Political Editor Raphael Baer to talk about the week in politics. It has been not a vintage week, I think it's fair to say. We're still in recess at the moment. But the big news, if you can call it that, is that David Cameron and George Osborne appear together, smiling, frolicking in the spring sunshine, verily. Raph, why are they looking so happy?
Well, they're looking happy because the economy is growing, and they think that gives them a substantial advantage over Labour, who they will say predicted that the economy wouldn't grow and it would never grow again, and that we'd all be foraging in the woods for grubs and berries, and it hasn't happened, and therefore they are vindicated. And the crucial point here, up to in terms of the presentation of it, is that it's the two of them together saying we are the team with a long-term plan to save Britain, and then the crucial caveat that follows to that is, but there's more to be done. In other words, don't think it's solved and that you can have a nice luxury Labour government back again. You know, we still need to be, you still need a bit of Tory toughness in the mix. The contrast that they want to bring into people's minds is with Ed Miliband and Ed Balls, who, certainly in Westminster, it is recognised, don't necessarily always sing from the same hymn sheet, and also who their focus groups tell them people look at and think, no, I don't really want you running my economy, thanks very much. And so from that point of view, you know, this is their single most potent line of attack, and they're, you know, blooming well going to press hard on it.
And George, it's been remarkable, hasn't it, in this government, how united David Cameron and George Osborne have been all along, even if they haven't necessarily made public appearances together.
Yes, I think that's partly because David Cameron isn't a particularly ideological figure.
So this is his idea that he's the chairman, not the CEO, right? So he wants to sort of coast above it all, kind of letting people get on with their own things and just kind of generally keeping an overview.
Exactly. And Cameron is a naturally conciliatory figure, which is one reason why coalition has suited him. But I also think they've learned from the Blair-Brown experience. I mean, they were fascinated by the New Labour project and also by how the tensions between Blair and Brown meant that the government was nowhere near as successful as it could have been.
It's also quite important that George Osborne was self-aware enough in opposition to recognise that he probably wasn't the person to be Prime Minister, but he could still have a lot of power as Chancellor, the obvious contrast being there with Gordon Brown, who felt forever that, you know, he'd been usurped in some way. And ultimately, you know, when Michael Howard was anointing the younger generation of his shadow cabinet, his first thought for future leader, possible prime minister, was Osborne. And reportedly, it was Osborne who said to him, no, that Cameron, he's your man for the front of house stuff. And being an immensely powerful Chancellor is in many ways a better job than being Prime Minister.
And a great patron and bringing people on through the ranks, right? The last couple of reshuffles have seen Osborne. There was a great line in your column, wasn't it? If you want to be promoted, what is it you have to be?
A woman or have a regional accent or be Matt Hancock.
So basically an Osborne protégé.
Friend of George.
But there's an interesting point about coalition politics as well here, isn't there? Because the Damien McBride book about being Gordon Brown's spin doctor sort of says the only way to get a very boring policy announcement any traction was to play it as part of a Tony Blair Gordon Brown row. And that's how you could kind of get road building in Solihull to be kind of an interesting, sexy story. Now what happens is that becomes a coalition row, doesn't it? It becomes, you know, free school meals or welfare cuts.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, there are definitely two different kinds of coalition rows. There's the ones that are sort of permitted public airing, where there has been some negotiated settlement, and it's recognised that the Lib Dems want to get... need definition for themselves, and they can do that against the Tories, and the Tories are happy with that because they get definition, certainly, you know, with the right wing of their party, if they are seen to be in conflict with Lib Dems. And then there's the ones that you probably hear about necessarily much less that are also going to be the ones that are much more bitter, which are things that they can't agree on. Or, you know, for example...
Yeah, what's an example of that?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I think when you run up to the budget where they did the tax cuts... the top rate tax cut, and there was discussion of the mansion tax. I think there were some quite difficult conversations there where actually George Osborne was prepared to see the case for a mansion tax or some kind of wealth tax, and David Cameron was very much of the view that, you know, this hurts our people and we can't do it. And then the lines were a bit blurred, and that was that's the sort of argument that it wasn't sort of briefed out until after the event when the Lib Dems wanted to prove that in fact they tried very hard to get, you know, to nail the rich.
And George, there's also a difficult position for Labour here, because it is sort of generally accepted now that they've comprehensively lost the ability to make that argument that actually if you'd done Keynesian policies at the start, there would have been, the recovery would have been better. It's very hard to make the kind of, yes, we're recovering now, but we should have recovered sooner argument. Where does that leave them in terms of what they have to sell on the economy?
Well, you're right about that argument sort of dissipating and collapsing, which is why they made that shift last summer to the cost of living. And they've adopted that as their strategy. The question that they are going to ask in 2015 is, are you better off or worse off than you were 5 years ago? And the answer is going to be, no, you're not.
Is it, though? They're definitely.
It is, yes.
Really,
I mean,
definitely.
The IFS, every economist in the business says, you know, it is inconceivable that just a year of wages sort of crawling above inflation is going to be enough to reverse the £1,600 average loss since 2010. They are going to stick with that strategy, and the decision to recruit David Axelrod is reflexive of that. I mean, what was significant is that he's not just a gun for hire, but he accepts Ed Miliband's intellectual analysis that the fundamental problem in Western societies is the severed link between the growth of the national economy and the stagnant growth of family finances.
So for those who don't know, David Axelrod was a long-term Obama strategist, helped run the 2012 campaign, yeah. Was involved before then as well?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, in fact, involved since Obama's Senate race in Chicago. So, I mean, the Obama strategist, the sort of definitive strategist, inevitably, as with all of these appointments, I think there's been slightly too much sort of excitement and hype around it in the extent to which he will actually change Labour's fortunes is probably negligible. But it's significant that he accepts Miliband's analysis. There's a genuine sort of centre-left shared assessment of the economy and society. And also there is a vote of confidence that he, although he has worked with candidates he've lost before, he clearly would not be working for Ed Miliband, who didn't think he had a good chance of becoming Prime Minister.
And Raf, it was a big to-do last summer when George Osborne had Jim Messina to advise the Tories on their election campaign. Why are both the big parties so enthralled to America? Is it just because they watched The West Wing when they were growing up, and
yes,
they wished that they were Josh and Toby in The West Wing?
Well, first, no, they were mostly grown up, I think, by the time of The West Wing. But there is an element of romanticising American politics. I think there is also a crisis of kind of connection between British politics and the electorate, and you've seen that. This is the reason why UKIP are doing well. I mean, ultimately, there is none of the, as it were, mainstream frontline candidates has really found a language to to create inspiration or enthusiasm among voters. That's because they've reached a limit of what they can do in terms of inspiration. And I think there is still a degree, a sort of a romantic idea of the Obama campaign, particularly for 2008, also to an extent 2012, which is actually quite out of date in the US. I mean, you speak to most Americans, they say, you know, Obama's, he's becoming a lame duck. He's lost his touch. He's sometimes seen as aloof. There's the equivocations. The healthcare stuff wasn't handled well. All of that. But that doesn't matter here. He's still a political pinup, and he's seen as a sort of a political commodity that has a certain allure that simply, I mean, no one won the last election, and it looks very probable that no one will win the next one. And so anyone who's got the luster of victory around them is a hot property.
So the Labour's kind of idea about are you better off now than you were in 2010 is got to be just about the most kind of telegraphed punch in history. So what will the Tory response to that be?
Well, first of all, the Tory response will be, what are you going to do about it? Because you know, they say we've delivered growth. Growth is what makes people better off. If you have a growing economy, you can cut taxes. You can cut taxes for ordinary, hardworking people. We've got a plan, and our plan is working. You're just sitting around pointing at things and complaining about how expensive they are. And that is a problem for Labour, that they haven't, and it's been a problem for a long time, they have an analysis, they don't really have a prescription, or at least the scale of the prescription isn't equal to the scale of the problem they claim to be identifying. And of course, the other part of the Tory response will be, they're all very clever, but Ed Miliband, come off it. And it'll be a very personal attack on the character and leadership credentials of the leader of the Labour Party, on the grounds that a lot of people look at him and just simply don't think he is capable of rising to the challenge of being Prime Minister, and the Tories aren't going to be squeamish about punching that bruise.
And George, in a feature I've literally just this second decided to introduce from now on, where are the polls now on for the party's voting intentions for
next election? They're all over here taking our jobs, according to you, bro. Sorry.
You've got an average Labour lead of around 4 or 5 points at the moment.
And the Scottish independence referendum?
Oh, so these are predictions for...
Let's do both. This is the Scottish independence referendum.
In some polls, the gap is as narrow as 3. In others, it's as wide as 15. The No campaign have an average lead of around 8.
Okay, well, remind
council
me.
Council by-elections in South London.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, how are things in East End?
Well, in the Europeans, interestingly, I mean, despite the upsurge in publicity for UKIP, I mean, albeit some of it negative, Labour have this stubborn, small but stubborn lead in the Europeans. But as UKIP strategists point out, they always have a late surge in the Europeans. And this big poster campaign they've launched, you know, £1.5 million, that will inevitably raise their profile even further.
OK, well, remind me to do this again next week, or it'll be the shortest lived feature in history. Thank you, George and Raph.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm joined by our science and technology writer Ian Stebman to talk about tragedy on Everest. Last week, 16 Sherpas were killed in an avalanche as they were trying to prepare the mountain for this season's climbers. Ian, so tell me about this very odd thing that happens on Everest, because so many people want to climb it.
Yeah.
They've essentially instituted kind of trails up there that are the other kind of approved trails.
Yep. There are a limited number of ways to get up to the summit. At the moment, there are about 600 people who climb Everest each year. They pay sometimes as much as $100,000, which goes towards equipment and training and to license fees to the Nepalese government to climb up the mountain. It's easier to climb from the Nepalese side. And at the moment, that's so many people that you kind of get traffic jams on Everest, which is crazy to think. There was a famous photo last year of a climber took of people queuing, waiting to go up to the summit, just this long queue of climbers waiting to go up.
That's insanely dangerous, isn't it? Because above a certain height, you're essentially in what they call the death zone.
The death zone.
So the air is incredibly thin there, and you can only... I think there's a saying, once you're above that height, you're dying.
Yes.
You just have a certain amount of time in which to get to the top.
Exactly. It's not the kind of thing either.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
the oxygen tanks can help with, because oxygen tanks are pretty heavy and they don't last very long. So there's really kind of, you have to get in and get out. They say that if you fall over or you can't get up or anything, other people have to leave you because they really won't have the strength to continue.
Well, this is what I find one of the most macabre things about the idea about climbing Everest, is that you have to climb past, and they're essentially kind of landmarks on the way up. There's a guy who's known colloquially as Green Boots, because he died there several years ago, and because you don't decompose because of the altitude and the cold.
He's just where he kind of crawled into a little alcove and died. And I think that was in the 80s he died. He's still there and he's a waypoint. Very macabre. But he won't decay. But that's kind of a big problem with Everest, that nothing decays up there. It's so cold. So there are empty oxygen tanks, empty food wrappers. There's a lot of poo everywhere. That's a big problem. It's estimated to be about as many as 50 tons of rubbish on Everest, which isn't going anywhere. It doesn't blow down. It just stays there.
So one of the things that was hoped to happen, I mean, the climbing season for this year, which is only essentially 2 months long anyway, has been cancelled, right? But one of the things that they had been hoping to do was forcing everyone to bring some of this.
They were hoping to introduce this rule that everyone would have to bring 8 kilograms of rubbish down with them. Most people go up the mountain carrying about 20 kilos, and they thought that they would be able to handle maybe 8 kilos to bring it down. But even at the rate of 600 people a year, that would take most of a decade to clear the mountain of the rubbish. And it's not clear how, if they're going to be able to do that, because, well, there is this strike as well, which is because effectively it's too dangerous for too little reward. Sherpas are actually, it's quite a prestigious job in Nepal. Is the climbing season is about 3 months long, and you tend to earn about 10 times as much as the annual median wage there. You can earn up as much as $6,000 a year, which doesn't sound a lot to us, but by the standards of the Nepalese economy, that is huge.
Well, this is one of the things that I find kind of fascinating and horrible about Everest climbing, because obviously it has become a sort of badge of honor. Not only that there are a lot of people who are climbing enthusiasts who climb everything, you know, and this would be the pinnacle of their career, but there's also a certain kind of essentially person who isn't up to climbing it, who wants to kind of go on the closest to thing you can possibly get to a kind of guided tour up there. And you can even get people to carry your bags for you.
Yeah, it's become part of the global sort of extreme sports industry. You see, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this, like people on Facebook saying, "I'm fundraising to go climb Everest," or something, people that you know, and kind of think, well, really, you're climbing Everest? Even something like Kilimanjaro is pretty serious, but people seem to do that as if it's a stroll in the park these days, when they maybe shouldn't.
But that's one of the things I have to say, I find that quite distasteful, because essentially you're going into an economy that is, you know, Nepal is not a rich country, and people who've got an enormous amount of money, even if they're fundraising, are still relying on, you know, very cheap foreign labour in order to do. And let's face it, there are other ways to fundraise that don't involve you also getting to post it, like, oh, here's a selfie of me at the top of Everest.
Yeah, there are all kinds of problems that come from the tourism industry always. But Nepal, it's kind of interesting that the rubbish on the mountain kind of becomes symbolic for the entire problem with pollution and natural decay in Nepal. I mean, a lot of the, it's an economy that's still heavily reliant on subsistence farming. And, you know, forests are being destroyed and the soil is being eroded away, and it's quite a hard place to live a lot of the time.
Well, it's a very hard place to live in terms of that some of those places have got practiced sky burial. So because you can't get down through the permafrost, you can't bury people, and because you can't afford the fuel to burn people, then essentially you are kind of hacked to pieces and left for vultures to eat your body so that you return to the soil. And that's actually, you know, as ways of kind of dealing with dead people go, that is an ecologically friendly one.
Yeah.
It does emphasize quite how little spare kind of give there is in the landscape.
But I think it's also Everest, and climbing Everest is a huge part of the Nepalese economy. It generates $3.3 million per year in government revenues, which is something like half a percentage point of the total GDP of Nepal. So that's, I don't know exactly an industry that's comparable to in the UK, but you can imagine if there was an industry that had 0.5% of the economy going on strike, that would have a lot of sway. They want the insurance given out to Sherpas who have died, their families, go up to 2 million rupees, which is about $22,000. And I imagine they'll be successful simply because they're such a vital part of the Nepalese society and culture.
It's fascinating because Bhutan, for example, which is also a really mountainous place, has decided to essentially limit tourist visas to only people who come in on really high-end luxury tours because they feel that they don't want herds of people tramping through because it will spoil all the things that it's supposed to celebrate. Yeah. But also they might as well try and extract the maximum value from the people who do come.
Which is interesting considering that's Bhutan, which has, you know, gross national happiness instead of GDP is its measure of economic success.
Well, I think there's a point about trying to weigh up the economic advantages of tourism industry with the disruptive influence and all the things that come along with tourism. You know, for example, like the sex industry, for example, which is something that if you have an influx of foreigners who have got loads of money to spend and far more than the local population, that can lead to some extremely exploitative practices. Anyway, on that rather somber science and technology note, I will say thank you to you for this week, Ian.
Thanks.
I'm joined by our staff writer Sophie McBain to talk about anxiety. Now, you wrote about this subject for a cover story for the magazine, which was really well received. It turns out that quite a lot of people in journalism and politics are incredibly anxious. And why is that? Because, I mean, you talk about in the piece about whether or not it's kind of what people would now refer to as a first world problem. It's what you can, you know, what goes wrong in your life when there's nothing else to go wrong. Is that a fair assessment or is that unfair?
I think it's actually a little unfair. I think probably most people have a relatively similar level of, or rather your position, whatever country or class or profession you're in, you probably have a relatively similar chance of being anxious. But I think different people feel more able perhaps to label what they're feeling as anxiety. So for instance, there was a study done and I've completely forgotten the person's name, but he found that people were equally anxious in countries like India and developing countries where traditionally they're much less likely to report anxiety if polled.
So this is this idea that actually it's one of those things that you might only talk about if there isn't anything else in your life because it's not seen as a natural reaction. If you're undergoing extreme stress in your life, then it would be strange not to be anxious. So what we're talking about here is being anxious in the absence of any obvious external factor. Is it getting worse?
I personally don't think it's getting worse. I think lots of people write about the fact that it's getting worse and people point to, in terms of short-term changes, they point to the recession and squeezed living standards in the UK or even modern technology. And then you can take a much longer view and say there's something about modern society and the breakdown of the nuclear family. But actually, if you look through history, lots of people at different points of time have thought that they live in a uniquely anxious age.
And I suppose we should clarify what you mean by anxiety, because the book that came out, The Age of Anxiety, detailed a writer of The Atlantic and the kind of extreme anxiety that he suffered to the extent that he was like pretty much lost control of all his bodily functions right before he would go on stage. So what identifies what is as a medical condition, what defines anxiety?
Well, so the medical definition is that you have to have severe feelings of anxiety and then accompanied by a kind of checklist of other symptoms like sleeplessness or muscle tension. And one of the interesting things about the medical definition is that there's no sense in which your anxiety should be proportionate to what you're suffering,
sort of external causes.
So someone who's extremely anxious because they're
suffered a bereavement or their marriage has broken down or something like that, there's no difference between that and somebody who, on the surface of it, everything's going right, which I suppose makes it the obvious analogue of depression. And there's been the similar debate about depression, and is depression sometimes a reaction to, you know, when terrible things happen to you, it would be strange not to go into, a kind of the black dog, versus the fact that people struggle with the idea that why should I feel like this? Why should I feel like I just cannot get out of bed in the morning, I cannot do anything in my life when I have got essentially a brilliant life?
Yeah, and actually anxiety and depression are very, very closely linked. So quite often, if you're depressed, you suffer from extreme anxiety and the other way around. So there's quite high comorbidity.
And there's a big debate as well about the medicalization of kind of psychological states. So you talk in the piece about the idea of panic attacks as a thing, separate from anxiety, as a thing that happens, didn't really exist until someone wanted to market a drug that countered panic attacks, right?
Yeah. I think there definitely is. I think the pharmaceutical industry has played a very big role in terms of how we label our feelings, and that it doesn't necessarily mean that modern drugs created anxiety or that they created depression, but they did. They have shaped the way that we view ourselves and the way we label those emotions.
And finally, if you do suffer from really high anxiety, maybe as you're listening to this podcast, you'll suddenly realise that is actually what you, there is a name for what you're suffering. What are the practical steps you should do? I mean, I presume that if it comes to this point where you are in the state that the person who wrote the book is, you should definitely seek a doctor's opinion. But generally, what can you do in your life to reduce your levels of anxiety?
Well, for something that can be really quite crippling and debilitating, most of the advice is fairly pedestrian. It involves eating healthily, making sure you get enough sleep, doing exercise. But I also think that it's always worth going to see your GP if you are feeling really anxious, because I don't really think that people should have to feel unnecessary anxiety.
And how good do you think that GPs are now with dealing with the conditions like that? I mean, I presume a lot of the fear of people visiting their GPs comes from the idea that you'll be sent home again with kind of come back when you've got a real problem.
Yeah, well, I think that speaking to people who've suffered anxiety for decades, they do think that GPs have got better. But someone from a mental health charity told me that actually a third of GP cases are mental health conditions, and they don't receive that kind of same proportion of training. So in my personal experience, I think it's a bit of a lottery. You could get a GP who's really, really switched on and informed about mental health problems, and you can get someone who really doesn't quite know how to deal with them.
And you mentioned the charity there, Mind, who I presume if you look on their website, there's probably more information there as well.
Yeah, and another one called Anxiety UK.
Okay, well, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Sophie.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. We're produced by Philip Morn, and our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.